part five. I had to wait a while to pull myself together, and then I knocked, slowly, three times. I heard Andre shuffling behind the door, then his hand fumbling with the lock. And the door opened. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw that he was standing behind the door, but without looking round, I carried the bowl of milk to his desk. He was evidently watching me, and I must at all costs appear calm and collected. "Cherie, you can count on me," I said gently, and putting the bowl down under his desk lamp, the only one alight, I walked into the next room where all the lights were blazing. My first impression was that some sort of hurricane must have blown out the receiving booth. Papers were scattered in every direction. A whole row of test tubes lay smashed in a corner. Chairs and stools were upset, and one of the window curtains hung half torn from its bent rod. In a large enamel basin on the floor, a heap of burned documents was still smoldering. I knew that I would not find the fly Andre wanted me to look for. Women know things that men only suppose by reasoning and deduction. It is a form of knowledge very rarely accessible to them, and which they disparagingly call intuition. I already knew that the fly Andre wanted was the one which Henri had caught, and which I had made him release. I heard Andre shuffling around in the next room, and then a strange gurgling and sucking, as though he had trouble in drinking his milk. "Andre, there is no fly here. Can you give me any sort of indication that might help? If you can't speak, rap or something, you know, once for yes, twice for no." I tried to control my voice and speak as though perfectly calm, but I had to choke down a sob of desperation when he rapped twice for no. "May I come to you, Andre? I don't know what can have happened, but whatever it is, I'll be courageous, dear." After a moment of silent hesitation, he tapped once on his desk. At the door I stopped, aghast at the sight of Andre, standing with his head and shoulders covered by the brown velvet cloth he had taken from a table by his desk, the table on which he usually ate when he did not want to leave his work. Suppressing a laugh that might easily have turned to sobbing, I said, "Andre, we'll search thoroughly tomorrow, by daylight. Why don't you go to bed? I'll lead you to the guest room, if you like, and won't let anyone else see you." His left hand tapped the desk twice. "Do you need a doctor, Andre?" "No," he rapped. "Would you like me to call up Professor Angers? He might be of more help." Twice he rapped "no" sharply. I did not know what to do or say, and then I told him. "Henri caught a fly this morning, which he wanted to show me. But I made him release it. Could it have been the one you were looking for? I didn't see it, but the boy said its head was white." Andre emitted a strange metallic sigh, and I just had time to bite my fingers fiercely in order not to scream. He had let his right arm drop, and instead of his long-fingered muscular hand, a gray stick with little buds on it like the branch of a tree hung out of his sleeve almost down to his knee. "Andre, mon chéri, tell me what happened. I might be of more help to you if I knew. Andre, oh, it's terrible," I sobbed, unable to control myself. Having rapped once for yes, he pointed to the door with his left hand. I stepped out and sank down, crying, as he locked the door behind me. He was typing again, and I waited. At last he shuffled to the door and slid a sheet of paper under it. "Helene, come back in the morning. I must think, and will have typed out an explanation for you. Take one of my sleeping tablets and go straight to bed. I need you fresh and strong tomorrow." "Ma pauvre chérie." "Eh? Do you want anything for the night, Andre?" I shouted through the door. He knocked twice for no, and a little later I heard the typewriter again. The sun full on my face, I woke up with a start. I had set the alarm clock for 5, but had not heard it, probably because of the sleeping tablets. I had indeed slept like a log, without a dream. Now I was back in my living nightmare, and crying like a child, I sprang out of bed. It was just on 7. Rushing into the kitchen without a word for the startled servants, I rapidly prepared a trayload of coffee, bread and butter, with which I ran down to the laboratory. Andre opened the door as soon as I knocked and closed it again as I carried the tray to his desk. His head was still covered, but I saw from his crumpled suit and his open camp bed that he must have at least tried to rest. On his desk lay a typewritten sheet for me, which I picked up. Andre opened the other door, and taking this to mean that he wanted to be left alone, I walked into the next room. He pushed the door to, and I heard him pouring out the coffee as I read. "Do you remember the ashtray experiment? I have had a similar accident. I transmitted myself successfully the night before last. During a second experiment yesterday, a fly, which I did not see, must have got into the disintegrator. My only hope is to find that fly and go through with it again. Please search for it carefully, since if it is not found, I shall have to find a way of putting an end to all this." If only Andre had been more explicit. I shuddered at the thought that he must be terribly disfigured, and then cried softly as I imagined his face inside out, or perhaps his eyes in place of his ears, or his mouth at the back of his neck, or worse. Andre must be saved, for that the fly must be found. Pulling myself together, I said, "Andre, may I come in?" He opened the door. "Andre, don't despair. I am going to find that fly. It is no longer in the laboratory, but it cannot be very far. I suppose you are disfigured. Perhaps terribly so, but there can be no question of putting an end to all this, as you say in your note. That I will never stand for. If necessary, if you do not wish to be seen, I'll make you a mask or a cowl so that you can go on with your work until you get well again. If you cannot work, I'll call Professor Ange, and he and all your other friends will save you, Andre." Again I heard that curious metallic sigh as he rapped violently on his desk. "Andre, don't be annoyed. Please be calm. I won't do anything without first consulting you, but you must rely on me. Have faith in me and let me help you as best I can." "Are you terribly disfigured, dear? Can't you let me see your face? I won't be afraid. I'm your wife, you know." But my husband again rapped a decisive no and pointed to the door. "All right. I'm going to search for the fly now, but promise me you won't do anything foolish. Promise me you won't do anything rash or dangerous without first letting me know all about it." He extended his left hand, and I knew I had his promise. I will never forget that ceaseless day-long hunt for a fly. Back home, I turned the house inside out and made all the servants join in the search. I told them that a fly had escaped from the professor's laboratory and that it must be captured alive. But it was evident they already thought me crazy. They said so to the police later, and that day's hunt for a fly most probably saved me from the guillotine later. I questioned Henri, and as he failed to understand right away what I was talking about, I shook him and slapped him and made him cry in front of the round-eyed maids. Realizing that I must not let myself go, I kissed and petted the poor boy, and at last made him understand what I wanted of him. Yes, he remembered. He had found the fly just by the kitchen window. Yes, he had released it immediately, as told to. Even in summertime we had very few flies. Because our house is on the top of a hill, and the slightest breeze coming across the valley blows round it. In spite of that, I managed to catch dozens of flies that day. On all the window sills and all over the garden I had put saucers of milk, sugar, jam, meat, all the things likely to attract flies. Of all those we caught, and many others which we failed to catch, but which I saw, none resembled the one Henri had caught the day before. One by one, with a magnifying glass, I examined every unusual fly, but none had anything like a white head. At lunchtime I ran down to Andre with some milk and mashed potatoes. I also took some of the flies we had caught, but he gave me to understand that they could be of no possible use to him. If that fly has not been found tonight, Andre, we'll have to see what is to be done. And this is what I propose. I'll sit in the next room. When you can't answer by the yes-no method of rapping, you'll type whatever you want to say and then slip it under the door. Agreed? Yes, rapped Andre. By nightfall, we had still not found the fly. At dinner time, as I prepared Andre's tray, I broke down and sobbed in the kitchen in front of the silent servants. My maid thought that I had had a row with my husband, probably about the mislaid fly, but I learned later that the cook was already quite sure that I was out of my mind. Without a word, I picked up the tray and then put it down again as I stopped by the telephone. That this was really a matter of life and death for André, I had no doubt. Neither did I doubt that he fully intended committing suicide unless I could make him change his mind, or at least put off such a drastic decision. Would I be strong enough? He would never forgive me for not keeping a promise. But under the circumstances, did that really matter? To the devil with promises and honor! At all costs, André must be saved. And having thus made up my mind, I looked up and dialed Professor Angers' number. "The professor is away and will not be back before the end of the week," said a polite, neutral voice at the other end of the line. That was that. I would have to fight alone, and fight I would. I would save André, come what may. All my nervousness had disappeared as André let me in, and, after putting the tray of food down on his desk, I went into the other room as agreed. "The first thing I want to know," I said as I closed the door behind me, "is what happened exactly. Can you please tell me, André?" I waited patiently while he typed an answer, which he pushed under the door a little later. "Helene, I would rather not tell you. Since go I must, I would rather you remember me as I was before. I must destroy myself in such a way that none can possibly know what has happened to me. I have, of course, thought of simply disintegrating myself in my transmitter. But I had better not, because sooner or later I might find myself reintegrated. Some day, somewhere, some scientist is sure to make the same discovery. I have therefore thought of a way which is neither simple nor easy, but you can and will help me." For several minutes I wondered if André had not simply gone stark, raving mad. "André," I said at last, "whatever you may have chosen or thought of, I cannot and will never accept such a cowardly solution. No matter how awful the result of your experiment or accident, you are alive. You are a man, a brain, and you have a soul. You have no right to destroy yourself. You know that." The answer was soon typed and pushed under the door. "I am alive, all right, but I am already no longer a man. As to my brain or intelligence, it may disappear at any moment. As it is no longer intact. And there can be no soul without intelligence. And you know that. Then you must tell the other scientists about your discovery. They would help you and save you, André." I staggered back, frightened, as he angrily thumped the door twice. "André, why? Why do you refuse the aid you know they would give you with all their hearts?" A dozen furious knocks shook the door and made me understand that my husband would never accept such a solution. I had to find other arguments. For hours, it seemed, I talked to him about our boy, about me, about his family, about his duty to us and to the rest of humanity. He made no reply of any sort. At last I cried, "André, do you hear me?" "Yes," he knocked very gently. "Well, listen then. I have another idea. You remember the first experiment with the ashtray? Well, do you think that if you had put it through again a second time, it might possibly have come out with the letters turned back the right way?" Before I had finished speaking, André was busily typing, and a moment later I read his answer. "I have already thought of that. And that was why I needed the fly. It has to go through with me. There is no hope otherwise." "Try all the same, André. You never know." "I have tried 7 times already," was the typewritten reply I got to that. "André, try again, please." The answer this time gave me a flutter of hope, because no woman has ever understood or will ever understand how a man about to die can possibly consider anything funny. "I deeply admire your delicious feminine logic. We could go on doing this experiment until doomsday. However, just to give you that pleasure, probably the very last I shall ever be able to give you, I will try once more. If you cannot find the dark glasses, turn your back to the machine and press your hands over your eyes. Let me know when you are ready." "Ready, André," I shouted, without even looking for the glasses and following his instructions. I heard him moving around and then open and close the door of his disintegrator after what seemed a very long wait, what probably was not more than a minute or so, I heard a violent crackling noise and perceived a bright flash through my eyelids and fingers. I turned around as the cabin door opened. His head and shoulders still covered with the brown velvet carpet, Andre was gingerly stepping out of it. "How do you feel, Andre?" "Any difference?" I asked, touching his arm. He tried to step away from me, and caught his foot in one of the stools which I had not troubled to pick up. He made a violent effort to regain his balance, and the velvet carpet slowly slid off his shoulders and head as he fell heavily backwards. The horror was too much for me, too unexpected. As a matter of fact, I am sure that even had I known, the horror impact could hardly have been less powerful. Trying to push both hands into my mouth to stifle my screams, and although my fingers were bleeding, I screamed again and again. I could not take my eyes off him. I could not even close them, and yet I knew that if I looked at the horror much longer, I would go on screaming for the rest of my life. Slowly, the monster, the thing that had been my husband, covered its head, got up and groped its way to the door and passed it. Though still screaming, I was able to close my eyes. I, who had ever been a true Catholic, who believed in God, and another, better life hereafter, have today but one hope, that when I die, I really die, and that there may be no afterlife of any sort, because if there is, then I shall never forget. Day and night, awake or asleep, I see it, and I know that I am condemned to see it forever, and perhaps into oblivion. Until I am totally extinct, nothing can, nothing will ever make me forget that dreadful white hairy head, with its low flat skull and two pointed ears, pink and moist. The nose was also that of a cat, a huge cat, but the eyes, or rather, where the eyes should have been, were two brown bumps the size of saucers. Instead of a mouth, animal or human, was a long, hairy, vertical slit from which hung a black, quivering trunk that widened at the end, trumpet-like, and from which saliva kept dripping. I must have fainted, because I found myself flat on my stomach on the cold cement floor of the laboratory, staring at the closed door behind which I could hear the noise of Andre's typewriter. Numb. Numb and empty. I must have looked as people do immediately after a terrible accident, before they fully understand what has happened. I could only think of a man I had once seen on the platform of a railway station, quite conscious, and looking stupidly at his leg still on the line where the train had just passed. My throat was aching terribly, and that made me wonder if my vocal cords had not perhaps been torn, and whether I would ever be able to speak again. The noise of the typewriter suddenly stopped, and I felt I was going to scream again as something touched the door and a sheet of paper slid from under it. Shivering with fear and disgust, I crawled over to where I could read it without touching it. "Now you understand." That last experiment was a new disaster. My poor Helene, I suppose you recognized part of Dandolo's head. When I went into the disintegrator just now, my head was only that of a fly. I now only have its eyes and mouth left. The rest has been replaced by parts of the cat's head. Poor Dandolo, whose atoms had never come together. You see now that there can only be one possible solution, don't you? I must disappear. Knock on the door when you are ready, and I shall explain what you have to do. A. Of course he was right, and it had been wrong and cruel of me to insist on a new experiment, and I knew that there was no possible hope that any further experiments could only bring about worse results. Getting up, dazed, I went to the door and tried to speak. But no sound came out of my throat. So I knocked once. You can, of course, guess the rest, he explained his plan in short typewritten notes, and I agreed. I agreed to everything. my head on fire, but shivering with cold. Like an automaton, I followed him into the silent factory. In my hand was a full page of explanations, what I had to know about the steam hammer. Without stopping or looking back, he pointed to the switchboard that controlled the steam hammer as he passed it. I went no further and watched him come to a halt before the terrible instrument. He knelt down, carefully wrapped the carpet round his head, and then stretched out flat on the ground. It was not difficult. I was not killing my husband. André, poor André, had gone long ago. Years ago, it seemed. I was merely carrying out his last wish. And mine. Without hesitating, my eyes on the long, still body, I pushed the stroke button right in. The great metallic mass seemed to drop slowly. It was not so much the resounding clang of the hammer that made me jump as the sharp cracking which I had distinctly heard at the same time. The thing's body shook a second, and then lay still. It was then I noticed that he had forgotten to put his right arm, his fly leg, under the hammer. The police would never understand, but the scientists would, and they must not. That had been André's last wish also. I had to do it, and quickly, too. The night watchman must have heard the hammer, and would be round any moment. I pushed the other button, and the hammer slowly rose. Seeing, but trying not to look, I ran up, leaned down, lifted, and moved forward the right arm, which seemed terribly light. Back at the switchboard, again I pushed the red button, and down came the hammer a second time. Then I ran all the way home. You know the rest, and can now do whatever you think right. So ended Helene's manuscript. The following day I telephoned Commissaire Charras to invite him to dinner.
With pleasure, Monsieur Delambre. Allow me, however, to ask, is it the Commissaire you are inviting, or just Monsieur Charras?
Have you any preference?
No, not at the moment.
Well, then, make it whichever you like. Will 8 o'clock suit you?
Although it was raining, the commissaire arrived on foot that evening. Since you did not come tearing up to the door in your black Citroën, I take it you've opted for Monsieur Charras off duty?
I left the car up a side street, mumbled the commissaire with a grin, as the maid staggered under the weight of his raincoat.
Merci, he said a minute later, as I handed him a glass of Pernod, into which he tipped a few drops of water, watching it turn the golden amber liquid to pale blue milk.
You heard about my poor sister-in-law?
Yes, shortly after you telephoned me this morning.
I'm sorry, but perhaps it was all for the best.
Being in charge of your brother's case, the inquiry automatically comes to me.
I suppose it was suicide?
Without a doubt. Cyanide, the doctors say quite rightly. I found a second tablet in the unstitched hem of her dress.
Monsieur Esteve, announced the maid.
I would like to show you a very curious document afterwards, Charras.
Ah, yes, I heard that Madame Delambre had been writing a lot, but we could find nothing beyond the short note informing us that she was committing suicide.
During our tête-à-tête dinner, we talked politics, books, and films, and the local football club, of which the commissaire was a keen supporter. After dinner, I took him up to my study, where a bright fire, a habit I had picked up during the war, was burning. Without even asking him, I handed him his brandy and mixed myself what he called crushed bug juice in soda water, his appreciation of whiskey. I would like you to read this, Charras. First, because it was partly intended for you, and secondly, because it will be of interest to you. If you think Commissaire Charras has no objection, I would like to burn it after. Without a word, he took the wad of sheets Celine had given me the day before and settled down to read them. What do you think of it all? I asked some 20 minutes later as he carefully folded Helene's manuscript, slipped it into the brown envelope, and put it into the fire.
Gerard watched the flames licking the envelope from which wisps of grey smoke were escaping, and it was only when it burst into flames that he said, slowly raising his eyes to mine,
"I think it proves very definitely that Madame de Lumbre was quite insane."
For a long while we watched the fire eating up Helene's confession. "A funny thing happened to me this morning, Gerard. I went to the cemetery where my brother is buried. It was quite empty, and I was alone."
"Not quite, Monsieur de Lumbre. I was there, but I did not wish to disturb you."
"And you saw me?"
"Yes. I saw you bury a matchbox."
"Do you know what was in it?"
"A fly, I suppose."
"Yes. I had found it early this morning, caught in a spider's web in the garden."
"Was it dead?"
"No, not quite. I crushed it between two stones. Its head was white. All white.